Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another video. My guest today has a YouTube channel. His name is James Sino, or is it Sino?
James Sino, either way.
Sino, Sino. Okay, there we go. Pronunciation is not my strong point. James Sino, and you have a particular interest in Chinese history. I mean, before we get going here, what got you into Chinese history?
Well, I think it's a civilization which, in many ways, until the Silk Road, developed separately from our own. But also at the same time, in many ways, developed and noticed patterns, and their historians have noticed patterns in the same way that our historians have noticed patterns over the years. Mm. And that interested me. And then the drama of the characters that we'll get into today interested me as well. Having learnt the language, fortunately, that gave me access to these texts in a way that's different from many historians at the moment. And one of the reasons why I started the channel was because I realised many historians were either smearing or using the same kind of tactics that they do against our civilization about China. They do it right as well. So many of these so-called establishment historians do the same things where they undercut and undermine the West. They also do that about China as well. So I thought, well, there's a gap here that needs filling. So I started the channel.
Interesting. I mean, my knowledge of these matters is somewhat limited, I have to say. But my reading on this, where is it? I have it here. Oh, it's this book here. John Key, I mean, you're probably impossibly mainstream, but I learned a lot from that, because as somebody who knows absolutely nothing about Chinese history. But the one I really got into was this. Oh, I found this in a cafe, and I started reading it in a cafe, and then I found myself a copy. The author is Yong Yap and Arthur Cotterill. It's an old book, but when I started reading it, I was like, wow. They went through like stuff that happened in the Middle Ages here. They went through like 2,000 years ago, but you can see like really similar stuff. So I actually find it really interesting.
Absolutely. And yeah, the Duke of Zhou was talking about cyclical history in 800 BC. He just used terms like mandate of heaven. That's where we get the phrase the mandate of heaven from, is the Duke of Zhou. And he talked about how that was lost, and how someone would arise again who would take back the mandate of heaven in this cyclical version of history, just with different words from our own and a different flavor, perhaps.
So, what are we focused, just to set things up here, what are we focusing on today?
What we're focusing on is a topic I've thought about for a long time, is why the Qin unified China, but could not hold it, could not consolidate power. And I've been thinking about this for a long time and made videos, perhaps with another angle. And I realized that a lot of these themes that we talk about were implicit in that. And I haven't made it explicit before. I've always talked about the drama between the characters that we'll mention. And that is that the legalists who unified China were, in fact, lions, we might say, and the landed gentry or Confucians in many ways were the foxes. And that's what we're going to focus on today.
Right. The legal. I mean, I bought a book. Tell me if I'm well out, because this is not like my wheelhouse, but I have a kind of passing interest. I bought a book quite a long time ago and didn't really read it. It's just on my shelf over there. It's called The Book of Lord Shang. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
And when you said legalist, that made me think, well, is that are you talking about Lord Shang?
Yes. Yeah? Lord Shang. He was the first articulator and the first person to put it into practice. These ideas were around before him. There was a legalist by the name of Li Kuei. The fundamental character of legalism is that of a lion, someone who's not afraid to put force into practice and into use and emphasize the importance of law and reward and punishment. That was the core of legalism, and the state of Qin was the first place that was put into practice.
Yeah, that was my impression on everything. Lord Chang, you're pretty hardcore. All I was thinking is, this guy's hardcore, you know, authoritarian.
That's what in many ways, yes. And in some ways, there are some differences. And I think that springs from the context. We start in a civilizational winter in the fall of the Zhou. I could go back to the Yellow River civilizations. These were civilizations springing around the Yellow River back to the Banpur. But a useful starting point is the fall of the Zhou, a long-lived Zhou dynasty. Now, as we know, all civilizations, once they've established order, degrade over time in quality. And this happened with the Zhou. And during the spring and autumn period, which we know as the fall of the Zhou, that's when Confucius lived. And he traveled around various states looking for patrons to support his ideals of a moral and just, basically a Zhou restorationist in many ways. And it's worth bearing in mind that these peoples of these various states that broke off from the Zhou all at the same time saw themselves as the same people, despite their different states. For example, Confucius speaks of the Yi horse peoples being not like their own great civilization, that is the peoples north of the Wall, north of the Yellow River. They've gone through various names through the centuries, the Mongols, the Yi, in the end, the Manzus, which we might touch upon in another video. But it's worth bearing in mind, as I said, that these people saw themselves as the same. And as the Zhou degraded and we fall into a civilizational winter with these states incessantly warring with the losses of hundreds of thousands of people, this period saw the flourishing of ideas of Taoism. This is when Taoism comes into being, Moism, and the one that will eventually unify the warring states, that is legalism. And where, stop me if I'm going too fast and you want to check anything
well,
with
well,
me.
I think it's worth just, you know, for the person viewing at home, where are we in history here? I mean, right. Yeah, I mean, vaguely people will be aware of the warring states period, right? But in terms of dates, yeah. Where is this in history?
So Confucius lived in around 500 BC. So that was the spring and autumn period, the fall of the Zhou. And the warring states, there are arguments as to when it started, but it's in around about 500 to 450 BC. That was when these states started declaring themselves as hegemon, as opposed to the Zhou, which clinged on, but only to nominal power in the center. They only really controlled a region right in the center of China. But all these dukes started asserting their own power and warring each other with only nominal respect to the central long-lasting Zhou dynast.
One of the strange things that I remember when I was reading about this period, and also when I was into, you know, I was into Taoism for a while, reading about all of that sort of stuff, was that they had this strange system. There were these different dukes, as you mentioned, and different states and so on, but you had these scholars who were almost like kind of advisors for hire, and they'd circulate, and you could like hire Confucius for, you know, to come to your court and he'd give wisdom. And I mean, this was why when I was into Taoism, this is what put Lightsey apart, is because he just, you know, wouldn't be hired and then wandered off into the mountains or something.
But exactly, yeah, that was his reaction to the fallen civilizational winter. He decided that, you know, he would just go off into the mountains, and certain legends sprang up around him. It's very hard to tell the actual historical Lao Tzu, because most of this record is reliant upon Sima Qian, who's writing in around 90 BC. But yeah, absolutely. All these elite scholars, and most of them were Confucians. Now, there's much to be said for Confucianism. And over time, we're talking about 150 years or so after Confucius. A lot of these Confucians certainly didn't live as revolutionary lives as Confucius did himself, and were very squeamish with things like the use of force. Justifiably, Confucius never mentioned the use of force in his works. And there's over time, a sort of, one might say, in the worst sense, a snobbishness towards soldiering that developed in the Confucian literati. And at best, a sort of ignorance of it, a naivety. They wished to see a moral and just leader bring about a moral and just land by being moral and just in and of himself. And that was expected to emanate out to the masses. So they very much, and this is what we'll get into, they very much relied upon the legalists. No, there is no China without the legalists. The unification that we'll get to comes about because the state of Wei, from which Shanyang was born, actually ignored him. He had these ideas of reforming the state of Wei into a legalist system. But they would live to regret this because they ignored him. And his mentor, Gong Xiang Cuo, I think his name was off the top of my head, actually said to the leadership of the state of Wei, no, you better use Shanyang or kill him. So, and they did neither. They rejected his ideals, and he went to the state of Qin, who called for elites. As you were mentioning, these elites of various stripes were looking for patrons, and he allied with the Duke Shao of Qin. And this was around 356 BC. So we're talking about right in the middle of the Warring States period. Duke Shao listened to Shanyang's ideas. He was a driven man. He wanted to see the state of Qin restored to its former glory. It had once been the hegemon nominally of the Warring States period, back when his grandfather was the Duke. Now, these reforms were up against a entrenched elite of mostly landed gentry who would consider themselves as Confucians. We might frame this as perhaps a high-low cooperation, because Shanyang's reforms, one of the main driving factors was to bring about, and I know this name gets maligned in our circles sometimes, but a meritocracy. Regardless of where you were born, you could be rewarded with status and farmland. And regardless of where you were born, you could be punished. Eventually, when these laws did come into place, the Prince Qian himself would be punished for not bringing his nephew in line for bad behavior, and would actually be punished by having his nose cut off, rhinotomy. So these laws would apply right up to the top. So obviously, given the Confucian bent to a loyalty to a prevailing order and propriety, these laws were crikey, you know, these were very extreme measures. But from Shanyang's perspective, and this comes through in the Book of Lord Shang, the priority was to unify the states and end the wars. This has been going on for hundreds of years, just constant warring between the states, hundreds of thousands of lives lost. It advocates for clear laws and harsh punishments to be put out into every major town, every major village in the state, so that everyone knew clearly what the laws were. And as the story goes, Shanyang because he knew people didn't believe the government at that time, when they were first applied, went into the capital of Ying and said, we are going to reward everyone if they lift this pillar. They're about to build something, so they needed a pillar moved. We're going to reward whoever, it doesn't matter who it is, we're going to reward the person who moves this into our building site, into the town. And the village folks say, oh, you know, we don't believe this. This is nonsense. We've had experience with the government before. They don't do what they say they're going to do. One farmer, as the story goes, puts his hand up, says, I'll do it. And he goes, he lifts up the log, moves it into the town. And Shanyang rewards him with status and gold in front of the populace. This is to show, not tell, that they meant business, the legalists. They meant business. Now, you know, this ideal of harsh punishments and, you know, clear rewards should really be common sense to any of us with the experience of children or indeed groups of people badly in need of a firm hand. I think we're seeing that right now in our country.
Yeah, interesting. But what you wanted to talk about was how these people, the legalists, were not actually able to hold on to power. So we're going to get on to all of that. It's a kind of longer intro than usual, but it's fascinating stuff. Where can people find you, James?
I'm at James Eno on Twitter.
James Eno on Twitter. You are on YouTube as well, and I'll link it in the show notes. I have to mention that my book, Foundations of Shakespeare, is currently out, or is currently available on pre-order. If you pick up the course, you get 50% off if you send the receipt to the publisher. I also have my January sale on at the moment, promo code SHORJAN. We're going to play that ad, James. And then when we come back, you're going to explain why these legalists were not able to hold on to power in the long run. And I'm going to be fascinated to, because in theory, this seems to be a formula that should rule for a long time, right? So I'm fascinated to know why it didn't work. But first of all, though, I'm going to play the ad and we're going to come back.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure,
sure, sure, sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's ad mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, sure.
All right. So we're going to, because in my understanding, this stuff that you've been talking about with Lord Shang happened a little bit beforehand. This is kind of, bring us up to this point now where it starts going wrong for the legalists.
Within the state of Qin itself, Duke Xiaogong dies, and the entrenched class of landed gentry, having bided their time, have a very strong reason for vengeance against him, and they would actually make him a scapegoat. But as the Duke Xiaogong dies, after his ally, Duke Xiaogong dies, but they would not take back the laws. Therefore, various legalists like Li Si and Han Fei, and eventually Qin Shi Huang, would continue to apply these laws in the state of Qin. And this brought about a war machine. If you've got a motivated populace, and it certainly seemed to have worked, who fear punishments and know what they're going to get in reward for good behavior, they unify China. To cut a, to to cut a long story short, the eastern states fall to the Qin state one by one. But again, as within the Qin state, you have an entrenched class of landed gentry elite within all these various states. So therefore, the unification, which applies the things that it did within the Qin, the unifying, standardizing weights and measures and the language and so on, that process of, one might say, a unresolved spirit of vengeance against the unifiers still resides within the gentry from outside the state of Qin. And those landed gentry are basically just waiting for someone to rise up. Now, of course, this doesn't happen until Qin Shi Huang, the more steely-willed applier of these laws, dies. So this just goes to show that a seemingly invincible force can fall very, very rapidly indeed, because many of the nobles from outside the state of Qin, you know, they harbor a rightful vengeance, a rightful yearning for vengeance against the state of Qin. And I'd say it's only inevitable that someone would rise up. Only one, in fact, emperor after Qin Shi Huang dies. Now, there are various internal reasons as to why the Qin fell. Also, eunuch power seems to coincide with any dynasty on its way down in China. The same thing happened with Qin. It's recorded that eunuch Zhao Gao actually usurps rightful power of the second emperor, who should have been Fu Su, instead puts Qin Ershi in place. That's internal to the Qin. And also, they did not reform. They've reached their outer limits of their civilization. They've joined up the walls, but they've continued on those demands of the states from outside of Qin that Shanyang reformed it into having. For example, you were meant to supply the Qin state with a couple of months of labor duty every year. And these people would have to travel 1,000 miles from their conquered state to the capital to perform labor duty, like at the Terracotta Warriors. And that is where the next part of the story comes in, and how Liu Bang eventually arises and founds the Han Dynasty. It's because of the very fact that he was called to perform his labor duty in the capital and couldn't make it after a thousand mile long trudge to the capital. He couldn't make it. He rebelled in the end. But the legacy of the legalists, we're still living with today, that geographic core that they unified, and that geographic core of a people, and the idea of the unified Chinese language brought about by Shanyang's reforms. He did also include reforms, including standardizing language. They were just applied throughout the warring states in the unification. And we're still living with that today.
Now, one of the things I learned from those aforementioned books that I didn't know before, when you're talking about the core, that is not all of modern day China, right? It is a very specific area. In fact, I wonder if I can pull out the map from this book, because it might help us. It might help people know what we're talking about here. Let me see if I can pull out the map. When you talk about the core, it's that area there,
yeah,
that is got the kind of dotted line around it. That's the region that you're talking about when you talk about the core.
Pre-Qin. That was the core.
These areas here, yeah, mm-hmm, aren't included in China until later, okay, right?
Yeah. And there's a turning point. So that dotted area inside there, that's the pre-Qin unification. That was the Yellow River region. And mm-hmm, the Qin unified the two river regions, including the Yangtze. So including that southern area below that.
Down here.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so this, yes, includes all of this as well?
Pretty much, yes. That's always, okay, been the stable core.
interesting. So, roughly speaking, it's hard to do because you're kind of in reverse here, but it's like that.
That line there. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And
that's nice.
And this was in many ways a saving grace for Chinese civilization, because the Yellow River was an awful river to build a civilization on. Throughout the centuries, it's changed its course rapidly and killed hundreds of thousands of people because of its very high silt and sediment percentage, something like 40% silt. There's a peninsula called Shandong, and at some points in Chinese history, the river flowed south of that river, and for some points it flowed north of that peninsula. Mm-hmm. So having it take the southern Yangtze River, which is a lot more stable, was in many ways a saving grace for China. And since that time I mentioned that unification in 221, that's always been the core of Chinese civilization.
Now, just before we wrap up on this, my understanding is that, because you mentioned the landed gentry as a kind of power broking class, okay, or a significant section of the country that needed to be appeased in some way by power, and you're saying the legalists kind of displeased the landed gentry, which ultimately led to their overthrow. One of the things I remember reading was that in Chinese society, the merchant was not venerated at all. That in a strange way, they put even the farmer, the peasant, the working man above the merchant, and in a very deliberate way kept the merchant low. Can you tell me a bit about that? Because I always found that kind of interesting.
Yeah, Shanyang, in his Book of Lord Xiang, is very much against the merchant class. He saw them as very much against the state's interests. And Confucius didn't really speak that much to merchantry. He was really answering a different question. It was more how to live a moral life, how to live a just life. But they certainly didn't like merchants in the way that later theorists may have done. Although the irony is, of course, that Qin Shi Huang's own adoptive father was said to have been a merchant, but at the same time there is pretty strong evidence to suggest that most business went through the state in Qin. They banned farmers to sell their grain to merchants. They wanted everything to go through the state. There's pretty strong evidence that, over time, merchants certainly were not deemed wholesome at all.
Now, the reason why this is of interest, not just because it's kind of interesting in and of itself, is because, of course, China then later had a communist revolution under Mao. And I mean, it's still in theory a communist country. And but when I read that, I thought maybe this antipathy towards commerce, or this kind of distrust of the merchant, is pretty deep rooted. So it's kind of not that difficult to see when you see it's embedded all the way back then, to see how something like a peasant's revolution might come about, or something like the revolution that we actually did see in China, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a repeated pattern through history. The Chinese, their great missions to the Horn of Africa and across the Indian Ocean did not go to bring about trade. they had these massive galleons, bigger than our own European ones at the time. They were only sent to collect tribute. And even Mao himself barely left China. I think he may have been to Russia a few times, but I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. But Mao himself, the irony is, loved China, I know that we might question the way in which he loved it, perhaps, but he wrote poetry. He called back to the great poets of the Tang Dynasty, and he loved them, despite perhaps in some ways disliking the poets of his time, apart from himself, maybe. But yeah, certainly that is a running theme in China. They've never been in favor of pure merchantry and free trade.
So, did the distaste for the merchant prevent them becoming a power-broking group? Because, I mean, we talk about reoccurring patterns in history. In European history, there's a moment in which the merchants ally with opponents of the aristocracy in various different configurations. I mean, you could argue something like, the Glorious Revolution of 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution in this country. William of Orange, you know, he was allied with merchants, you could argue, right? Other examples are available. Were they a significant group despite the distaste for them? Did they help the landed gentry in their revolts and so on, or were they just kept so low that they weren't a player?
I'd say certainly they seemed to grow in power every time a dynasty would fall. That's for sure. I mean, the later Ming Dynasty, the end of the Ming Dynasty, the merchant class were really growing in power. And I mean, that's when Mayer's children have remembered things like the Antiques Roadshow, and there would always be the odd person coming on with a Ming vase.
Yeah.
And that was when the silk trade route really exploded post Marco Polo and all of that. So it certainly seems to precede a dynasty falling. In all of these periods that I've mentioned now, the merchant class were really, really frowned upon, certainly. Mm-hmm.
All right. So you want to kind of save the next bit for the next video, right? Where we go from here. I just want to in theory, the hard hand of the legalist state, you know, has got the kind of correct incentives. You know, you punish wrongdoers, you do it in such a way that nobody has any doubt as to who's in charge, but also what is right and wrong. You mentioned they were resented. Were they too harsh? I mean, why did people turn against them?
A combination of factors, I think, and we'll get into this into the next video, but the populist revolt at first was crushed in Dazishang. That was the first revolt. And then a noble blue blood, General Xiang Yu of the former Chu state, which was conquered in that unification process, his own grandfather passed away and died in the resistance. So there's this, we could frame it in a few different ways. One way I tend to think of these things is between I imagine the resentment, and I completely understand why someone like Xiang Yu would rebel against this. You know, he's seen his grandfather killed by the unification. No matter that the Qin dynasty had put an end to the warring, he still harbors this resentment, much like the Confucian landed gentry harbored a resentment against Shanyang within the Qin state. So I think it's a combination of the Qin dynasty failing to reform and also weak leadership at the end, with the second emperor who was a puppet. I suppose then also that the fact that now it was not a meritocracy anymore with the puppet emperor and Zhao Gao and the eunuch siphoning off the state for his own benefit. I suppose in some ways that certainly made it happen faster than it may have. Mm. But in many ways, what I'll get to perhaps in the next video, is that the Han Dynasty really piggybacked off the Qin legacy. They in many ways copied what the Qin did. They just ameliorated it and added a bit of a Confucian bent on things, but they still retain the laws. They still retain the unified language. They still retain the unified empire. They still retain the idea of a people. And that's where we get the name Han from now.
I mean, it's some part of it as well, you know, as a kind of student of Machiavelli and cyclical history and so on. I mean, it seems to me that you have an exceptional individual, a man of iron will, you know, a great leader, someone who's kind of, you know, wise and judicious. This would be Shang. And then you get, you know, then you get corruption and shitheads and that's when things, so in a strange way, the you know, you could say this configuration worked as long as the right guy was in charge, but then as soon as the right guy was not in charge, it fell apart.
Yeah, I think there's much to be said for both of them and how they interacted in Chinese history. Eventually, under the Han Dynasty, the two would sort of perfectly meld together with the meritocracy of an exam system, supposedly open to anyone, the imperial exam, being about matters of Confucian literature. So you have this literati class who spend all their time studying the Confucian classics, and yet they're in a way meritocratic. They get their position, as civil servants via an exam system, which, whilst imperfect, had its place. And also the fact that the breakdown of the core of China is baked into the cake of this system. And then having again to have a strong leader come up, as it happened in the Ming Dynasty, to bring about order once more. It's happened time and time again throughout Chinese history.
I should mention that one of the elite theorists, Giancarlo Mosca, in his famous book, The Ruling Class, which I talk about in Populist Illusion, was very enthusiastic, I recall, about that imperial exam system, because they always said it's a stronger elite that can cycle, that can take from anywhere and cycle those people in. But this is actually a strength. And if you keep the elite too exclusive, you lock too many talented people out, and they become a problem then. This is something, as I talked recently with Todd Lewis about meritocracy. He was wanting to defend meritocracy on a slightly different basis. He was trying to defend like the maverick, kind of disagreeable type. I'm not sure if the Chinese imperial state ever kind of promoted the maverick, but certainly they had, I guess we'd call it these days, social mobility, some route out.
Yeah. It worked for 2000 years almost. It worked for a very long time. The exam system only ended in around 1911. It worked. And yeah, it did, I suppose, give a way for some people who may have been deemed as of lower classes, a way out and a way up, to bring them in. And this is something that perhaps doesn't really exist in our context at the moment.
I believe the communist Chinese are still very keen on exams. I think Mao used to make people do exams to see the error of their ways, and they had to kind of write an essay on how I've fallen into error and all this sort of stuff. So I think even the communist state maintains some aspect of it seems like quite embedded in their, their way of doing things.
Communism with Chinese characteristics.
Exactly. All right. Well, this was very interesting, James. We've already mentioned you have a YouTube channel. I've linked it down in the show notes. You could pick up course at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN gets you 25% off all this month. Next time we're going to do a couple of these videos where we're going to kind of do what happens next and the establishment of the Han Dynasty in the next couple of videos. So see you again soon.
Grand. Thank you.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.